OMG. The Library of Congress wants to archive my tweets and your tweets and every public tweet ever. I found out about it on Twitter this week, which will please Andy Carbon, senior strategist for NPR's social media desk, and he's here in the studio. Andy, really, every tweet, even, you know, the what I had for breakfast ones?
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They're grabbing the whole kit and caboodle.
I mean, first of all, the Library of Congress is the oldest federal cultural institution.
Right.
Why does it believe tweets are important enough to archive?
Twitter, in many ways, has become the pulse of what's going on online right now. Because it's a real-time conversation that anyone can chime into at any given point, it's 24/7, and so when something happens somewhere in the world, you're almost guaranteed that people will be talking about it or even witnessing it as it happens, whether it's protests and revolution in Kyrgyzstan to people talking about the ham sandwich they just ate and everything in between.
But to quote Carl Sagan, there are billions and billions of tweets. I mean, how are they going to do this?
Yeah, tens and tens of millions of tweets per day. So on the one hand, it's just a matter of storing all this stuff and having enough space to keep it all. But then the big question will be, what kind of tools will they have available for researchers to parse through all of it and find what they're looking for? And that may not be a stretch either, because there are a whole range of third-party tools out there right now that will allow a person to go online, search for tweets. And so there are already ways that any of us on any given day can go and find information we're looking for.
A librarian of Congress, James Billington, said the Twitter Digital Archive has extraordinary potential for research into our contemporary way of life. What do you think tweets are going to tell us about ourselves in 100 years?
I don't know. I think people are going to be surprised and have forgotten that President Bieber used to be a singer before he got into politics. Twitter captures everything, and you're going to get a sampling of what life was like at its most mundane and banal and at its most tense and exciting and disturbing, because it really is just a reflection on what's going on at any given moment. And so it makes research rather onerous in some ways, but at the same time, historians and archaeologists are always often looking for the mundane because you can't always tell what everyday people were doing. Twitter, not only does it operate 24/7, it has tens of millions of people participating in it. And so suddenly it democratizes the snapshotting of the world in a way that's never been done before. It's the famous, it's the infamous that get captured for posterity, and now we're going to have a little bit of everything.
Andy Carbon is senior strategist for NPR's social media desk. Andy, thanks a lot. Don't forget to tweet.
Certainly won't.
This is NPR News. That old familiar feeling is back. Pain at the pump. Gasoline costs nearly $3 a gallon in many parts of the country, the highest level since the financial crisis hit in the fall of 2008. And this summer, expect even higher prices. NPR senior business editor Marilyn Geewax is here with the outlook for summer travel costs. Welcome back, Marilyn.
Hi, Leanne. It's good to be back.
Tell me the bad news. Why are gasoline prices higher?
Well, you know, it seems odd that gas prices have shot up so much. Last year at this time, gasoline was about $2 a gallon, and now it's getting close to about $3 a gallon, and in some places even higher than that. And a good part of that run-up has come in just the last 2 months, which is surprising when you consider that oil supplies have been very abundant this year. We're not yet in the peak driving season, and of course we still have millions and millions of unemployed people who are sitting at home not driving to work every day. So this seems like it should be the right formula for cheap gasoline.
But with fewer drivers on the road and abundant oil supplies, why did the prices go up?
The answer boils down to this. A lot of people around the world are just betting that demand for oil is going to shoot up faster than new supplies can be found in the next year or so. And recently I spoke with Daniel Yergin. You know, he wrote that book, The Prize, the famous book about the history of the oil industry. And he described this price run-up as expectations-driven. He says all over the world, investors are expecting that China and other Asia-Pacific and Middle East region countries, they're going to be using a lot more oil as their economies rebound. Now we have economists who are pretty much estimating that in the coming year, we're going to see oil increase by 1.5 million barrels per day, the demand for it increased. So even if you still have all these Americans unemployed who aren't commuting to work, people in other parts of the world are restarting their factories and their thirst for oil is going to grow.
Is it a given that Americans will be paying more at the pump this summer?
oil prices, they're very volatile, and we've even seen in recent days, you know, they can bump up a little and down a little. But in general, economists are expecting that higher prices are definitely coming our way. There's a federal agency that issued a report just this past week. It predicts that retail gasoline prices definitely will top $3 a gallon nationwide this summer. So that's not great news for vacationers. You know, in July of 2009, gas was about $2.50 a gallon. This July, maybe $3.10 a gallon.
Marilyn, what about airfares? Will they go up too?
Airlines are very much affected by the price of oil. As oil goes up, it sends up jet fuel prices, and that keeps the airlines looking for new sources of revenues. And that's really why you keep seeing more and more of those fees for luggage. Remember, every time you pack those bags, they're heavy, and that makes the plane weigh more, and that means the airline has to burn off more fuel. So they're going to charge you when you bring that suitcase. And earlier this month, we saw a lot of controversy when Spirit Airlines grabbed attention by saying they were going to charge $45 for even a carry-on. Well, this past week, some members of Congress have been talking about finding ways to prohibit those kinds of practices.
So will the airlines just impose more fees, or will the fares go up too?
I think we're going to keep seeing these fees, and also fares are headed up. Travelocity, an online travel site, said that fares for round trips this summer are up 13% compared with last summer. And Priceline, which is another online booking agent, says that by the time we get to the peak of the summer travel season, fares will probably be up about 25%. So the bottom line for travelers is if you really do want to go on a vacation this summer, you better save some more this spring.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Giwax. Thanks a lot, Marilyn.
Oh, you're welcome.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. How are we going to talk about what happened to us one day when it's over? That question is at the heart of Yann Martel's new novel, Beatrice and Virgil. At the heart of that question is another: what happened? In this fiction, the big event is the Holocaust, and the question is asked by several characters, not the least of which is Henry, a best-selling, critically acclaimed writer whose first book earned him piles of money and legions of fans. Not unlike the author of Beatrice and Virgil. Yann Martel wrote Life of Pi, which won the 2002 Booker Prize, was translated into 40 languages, and stayed on the New York Times bestseller list for 57 weeks. Yann Martel is in our Washington studio. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
There are two parts to the book, it seemed to me as I was reading it. And the first is about Henry the writer and his desire to write another piece of fiction. And it's a flip book on the Holocaust. Explain, first of all, what a flip book is.
A flip book would be a book with two sets of distinct pages that are brought together back-to-back upside down. So in other words, it's a book with two front covers. So if you flip your thumb through a flip book, you'll eventually get to pages that are upside down because you're looking at the other book, so you have to flip the book over. The reason I wanted to do that is I wanted to look at the Holocaust from every conceivable angle, both fictional and non-fictional. So I wrote a novel in the form of a play, and then I wrote an essay.
Yeah, a flip book always, I mean, a lot of kids' books are published like flip books. And I wondered, by taking on such a momentous event as the Holocaust, trying to write about it in a flip book reduces perhaps the idea of writing about it into an absurdity.
Well, I like the idea of a flip book in the sense when you're holding a flip book, the book is always half upside down. And symbolically, I kind of like the idea. When you eventually get to a central part, you haven't finished. You can't escape. You have to flip the book over and read again. So there's no escape.
Mm. Henry's publishers hated it.
Yes, yes.
And Henry quits. He decides to take a job in a chocolate shop. He acts with an amateur theater company. I'm curious, what did you do between Life of Pi and this book?
Well, I lived my life. The success of Life of Pi took 2 years of my life, touring and all that. It's a book that really connected with a lot of people. I also have an eight-month-old son. That's taken some of my time. I've also been writing to the Prime Minister of Canada every 2 weeks for the last 3 years, sending him a book also. And with that book, a letter explaining why I chose that book.
Do you know if he's reading them?
Well, I've not received a single response from him. Meanwhile, I get a letter from Barack Obama. Barack Obama wrote me a little handwritten note about Life of Pi, saying he and his daughter had read it and they'd enjoyed it.
One of Henry the writer's fans is another Henry, a taxidermist, and he stuffed a howler monkey, Virgil, and a donkey, Beatrice. He's written a play and asks the writer Henry to help him. Mm-hmm. So my question to you, Jan Martel, have you written plays? And why did you name them Beatrice and Virgil?
Very early on, when I started writing, yes, I wrote a few plays. But in this case, yes, I did write an entire play featuring Virgil and Beatrice. And it simply didn't work, in part because there were things that I wanted to say that I couldn't say in the play. So what I did is I completely rewrote it, and I added this layer of the taxidermist and the writer. So as you mentioned earlier, Henry the writer eventually stops writing, and the taxidermist is having problems with his play. So to have two people who in some ways are at a loss for words suited my purpose when discussing the Holocaust. You know, you always hear people at a loss for words for it. You know, it is unimaginable. There are no words for. Expressions like that occur all the time. You ask why Beatrice and Virgil? Well, it's from Dante's Inferno, Dante's Divine Comedy. They're the two guides of Dante through hell, purgatory, and heaven. And the Divine Comedy is another fantastic allegory.
I'm speaking with Jan Martel, author of the new novel, Beatrice and Virgil. Why the Holocaust? I mean, you were born in Spain. You live in Canada. Do you have a personal connection?
No, none whatsoever. I'm not Jewish. Both sides of my family have been in Quebec for 300 years. So mm-hmm. I'm a complete outsider, which was another issue, in fact, because if you start researching the Holocaust, it frightens me a little bit how overwhelmingly it is the victims and their descendants who comment on it. Of course, it's overwhelmingly a Jewish drama, but it's also a human drama. And so the dialogue has to go beyond that. It'd be as if every single book on rape were written by a woman, or every single book on racism by, in America, by an African American. You know, ultimately, the dialogue has to take in many, many people. So I needed an outside, another disguise. And I thought, well, if I can't approach it in human disguise, here I can do it in animal disguise.
Do you read your reviews?
Yes and no. It's interesting. This book has been very divisive because there was a terrible review in the New York Times, a terrible review in the Washington Post, and a terrible review in the San Francisco, I think it's called The Chronicle?
Yes.
I'm not sure. But then there's an extremely positive one in other papers, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, I think it was called, a very good one in the Huffington Post, I think it's called, which is interesting and perhaps to be expected, that we are very cautious about the Holocaust, which of course we should be. But let's compare it with war. The Second World War, by conservative estimates, cost the lives of 20 million people on the Allied side alone. I'm not talking about the Axis deaths, and I'm not talking about the Jewish deaths. And yet, we don't hesitate to relate war comedies. You know, we use war as a stage for any number of stories, many of which will make light of the reality of war. So my approach in no way is an intent to lighten the horror of that. It's on the contrary. You can't keep on telling it in the same way. Right now, because it's still relatively fresh, we still have survivors, our knowledge is still, relatively good. But we forget these great tragedies and we move on. And then what we are left with are its representations. And if we only have the same kind of representations, I'm afraid that a certain automatic kind of reaction will set in. You know, Primo Levi, at the end of his life, was often going to schools. And, you know, he'd be asked by children, for example, you know, why didn't you just leave? Why didn't you escape? You know, didn't you see it coming? You know, you're a chemist. You're an educated man. Why didn't you just leave? And, you know, he has to say, well, listen, you know, 1938 Europe was very different from 2000 and whatever. Most people didn't have passports. You know, people will make things that don't sit well, perhaps, but you have to talk to them. You have to be in dialogue. So this book is an attempt to be in dialogue. It is an attempt to create a small suitcase of the Holocaust, just a few essential elements. And if you're then interested, then you can go and read the big books. But it is an attempt to transform the Holocaust into a story.
Jan Martel is author of the new novel, Beatrice and Virgil, and he joined us in our Washington studio. Thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
You can read an exchange between the title characters, Beatrice and Virgil, and find a review of Jan Martel's new novel at our website, npr.org. Consider this short list of big league baseball players: Sammy Sosa, Robinson Cano, Alfonso Soriano, Tony Fernandez, Manny Alexander. What do they have in common? They're all from the small town of San Pedro de Macorís in the Dominican Republic, a town that's known for producing sugarcane and shortstops. In fact, by the year 2008, 79 boys and men from San Pedro have played in the major leagues. Writer Mark Kurlansky puts San Pedro under the microscope in his new book, The Eastern Stars. You may remember that he did the same thing in his books about salt, oysters, and cod. Mark Kurlansky is in our New York studio. Nice to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you, Lane.
Players from the Dominican Republic had started playing in the majors in the late 50s. What was it like for these players coming to America?
Well, it was very difficult. They didn't speak English. They didn't recognize any of the food. It wasn't the kind of food they were used to. Jose Cano, Robinson Cano's father, who was a pitcher, told me about how he learned to really like Whoppers. He couldn't speak much English, so he'd just go in and order Whoppers. And he could never remember if Whoppers were Burger King or McDonald's. He'd always go into the wrong one and get dirty looks. They also had a lot of problems with racism.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's tough to order when you don't speak English, but what about the idea of the racism?
Well, it was very difficult for them to understand. Because, first of all, a lot of them were mulatto, light-skinned, and didn't consider themselves to be black because, you know, black in Dominican Republic means really looking like an African or like a Haitian. So they'd go to minor league teams in the South and even in the early 60s, and they didn't think Jim Crow applied to them. And it got into a lot of difficulties, not only with racists, but with the African-American players who kind of resented this stand of I'm not really black. You know, they thought they should have shown more solidarity with the black players rather than insisting they were distinct from it.
Was there a concern that the black players thought that, you know, positions were being taken by the Dominicans?
African-American participation in Major League Baseball has been in a steady decline for the past 15, 20 years. And Latino and Dominican participation has gone up, which has led a lot of people to this leap that, you know, the Dominicans are replacing the blacks, you know, that they're hiring Dominicans instead of blacks, which really is not true. If anything, it's the other way around. They're hiring Dominicans because they can't get enough blacks. I've talked to a number of ex-major leaguers who worked on recruiting programs in inner cities. And, you know, these programs are dying. They can't get people interested. People want to play football and basketball where you can get to the big game and the big money a lot quicker than you can in baseball.
When the Dominican players came to play, you said they faced racism. But what about stereotype? I mean, the idea of someone, you know, these players having fiery Latin tempers, of course.
Yeah, the hot-blooded Latin.
Right.
Which, of course, isn't helped by hot-blooded Latins.
Right. You know,
there are also hot-blooded Anglos and there's mild-mannered Latins. But we remember Juan Marichal, you know, the only Dominican Hall of Famer. Great, great pitcher. And, you know, he was famous for his flare-ups, the most famous one. Pitchers coming too close, and he felt that they were playing games with him and deliberately trying to get too close and hit him, and the catcher kind of controls where the pitch goes. And Marichal just took his bat and beat Roseboro with it. This has sort of endured as an image of the Dominican player.
But given that the Giants pitcher Juan Marichal came and actually did hit Johnny Roseboro with a bat, doesn't that enforce the stereotype?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, especially when it happens to be the first really famous Dominican player. You know, it becomes this lasting image. And there have been others since. George Bell, who was from San Pedro. You know, I talked to them about this, and to this day he insists that it's the way you should play baseball. If the pitcher hits you with a pitch, you run out to the mound and belt him. Huh. He always would say, well, that's the way we play baseball in San Pedro. And I asked other people about this. Fernando Tatí, who plays for the Mets and is from San Pedro, I was asking him, and he was saying that, you know, he wouldn't play ball like that. And he said a very San Pedro-like thing to say. He said, you know, baseball has saved us and given us a livelihood and protected our families, and you have to treat it with respect.
Well, considering sometimes in the town of San Pedro, your choice was either cutting sugarcane or playing baseball.
I mean, that's an easy choice if you get to make it.
Right. Now, we're talking, you know, Major League Baseball pays piles of money.
The average salary is $3 million a year.
What would an average signing bonus be, though, for an individual player in these times?
Well, it just goes up and up all the time. Used to be a few thousand dollars, and now they're a few hundred thousand dollars. In 2008, Oakland signed a pitcher for $4.25 million, 16-year-old pitcher.
16 wasn't, years old?
Wasn't even a left-hander. But, you know, his family is okay now, no matter what happens. But even, you know, these guys who signed for $200,000, you know, you get $200,000, you've changed the life of everyone in your family. Mm-hmm. I mean, these people are living on hundreds of dollars a year. And, you know, you start talking about hundreds of thousands, it's huge.
How do you think these players have changed the American pastime?
You know, I don't know that so much they've changed it. I think they've done a lot to preserve it. They play really good baseball. You know, they start playing baseball in a serious way when they're 3 years old. One problem that I've talked to a lot of scouts about and a lot of people in Major League Baseball is that now it's becoming too much about money, and it's getting harder and harder to find Dominican players who just love the game.
Mark Kurlansky's new book is called The Eastern Stars, and he joined us from our New York studio. Thanks very much, Mark.
Thanks, Leanne. Always a pleasure.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.